Welcome to Discipleship Conversations, a Mission Alive podcast.
Hello, friends, and welcome to Discipleship Conversations. I'm Stephen Carazell. I'm here with co-hosts Jeremy Hoover and Tiffany Dahlman. And today we're going to be talking about an article that is fairly recent on Mission Alive's Substack newsletter. The article is by Chris Flanders called Kainos Koinonias. First of all, I'll just recommend, if you're interested, the Mission Alive Substack is a newsletter that comes out fairly regularly and contains some really good discussions that are a bit academic in nature. If you're interested in that, feel free to check in with Mission Alive and sign up, subscribe to the newsletter. But today we're just going to talk about the article that really stirred some thinking in us about churches and innovation, and which is the heart of what Mission Alive is doing. Hey, Jeremy. Hey, Tiffany. How are you doing?
Very well.
Good. Good.
All right. It's good to talk with you all today. We're going to get into some points that Chris Flanders, who is a missiologist and a friend of ours, he's with ACU, and he's got some experience as missionary, as a professor, and as someone involved in churches. He's got some really good observations about what missiology has to say with innovation and faith communities. And Jeremy, I'm going to start with you. There are lots of things to talk about in this article, but as three people who are connected to, let's just call it somewhat traditional, at least somewhat traditional church models, you know, people would look to us and find us by looking for a church at a location. And Jeremy, start us off with the things that stuck out to you about this article and what you're thinking about them, what they're making you think about in regards to your own experience in church and church planting.
Yeah, it was a great article. I don't know Chris, I guess, like some of you do. And so this was like brand new for me reading his work. And I thought it was really good. I think the easy thing when you read an article like this is to get captivated by the stories that he shares about some of the different churches. And so I was aware of that while I was reading and trying not to get too caught up in that. I struggle with what the article talks about. You know, when we're trying to innovate, are we innovating for reasons to do with the self? And I think that can apply to the congregation as a self as well. Or are we trying to innovate contextually from a proper missiological framework? And so when I read beyond the stories that he shared at the beginning, I really liked this idea that he shared about churches can use the image of resurrection to describe their life together, because often these stories have a quote unquote near-death experience as an important catalyst. And that really jumped out to me when I read it, because I thought that's a lot of times how it is in real life. Somebody will have something really catastrophic happen to them, and they'll describe it to other people. They'll say, this was a wake-up call for me. You know, I had to, if it's a health scare, I had to start doing better with what I ate or with exercise, or if they had an accident on the road, this was a wake-up call for me. I had to stop driving when I was really tired. And I think, at least in the circles I run in, it's easy to talk about churches are dying. And a lot of the ministers or the pastors that I talk with will kind of throw it out flippantly. My church is dying, or that's a church that's dying. And this part of his article really got me to think about the appropriateness of saying that or not. Like, I think it's not good, I think, to talk about a church is dying. Like, it's not like that's a move from the self. I think in a lot of ways, it's a reactionary way of talking about what's happening in the church. And if we want to think about this idea of innovation and think about it in terms of a resurrection from a near-death experience, I think we have to be able and willing in that church environment to say, what are the signs of death in this church? What are the areas where there should be life, but we're not seeing them? We're seeing decay. We're seeing dying. We're seeing death. And that takes a real degree of humility, I think, to look at something that for a lot of the folks in the church, they've given decades of their life to that church. And the willingness to come to the table at that point to say, I see death and we need to see life. And so I was just reflecting on what that would take, like how that plays in. I think that's one reason why churches end up not being able to make that move, is because there's not the awareness or the self-awareness in that church to be able to have those genuine, sincere conversations. Yeah. So I was able to read the article from that point of view and to think about my experience with churches, my current experience, and the experience of some pastors and ministers that I'm close to this day.
Yeah, that brings up so many of the thoughts I was having reading it. And I don't know, maybe Jeremy, I pushed back a little bit on the death, but now I'm thinking, yeah, resurrection, it's all there. We are at a crossroads. I think the church has experienced in the West that wake up call. You're talking about the car accident. And we have options of roads to go down. And some churches are taking one route. I think of organizations like Heritage 21 within the Churches of Christ that help churches die well, that are honest, like you were saying, humble. I think being honest, Chris talks about risk-taking, just, you know, brave to say, I see signs of death, and maybe we need to call death and bring in someone to help us die well. But there's another road, isn't there? There's a road of resurrection. And I think that's what Chris is talking about here in this road of resurrection. And what can that look like in these fresh expressions? And there's a lot of challenges to that. You mentioned the risk, but there's questions involved to me that are a challenge. There's a financial piece. It's a challenge. If you're looking at these fresh expressions he's talking about, you're not really looking at a living wage for a minister in 12 people in a living room. It just isn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, I still firmly believe in formal theological education for ministers in ministry and Bible. I think because I've seen so much church harm from people who don't have that schooling, but that costs money. So how can you justify that expense to be equipped for ministry when the future is 20 people around a dinner table or at a burrito bar? What does that look like? You know, there's practical challenges, theological challenges to that. And to your point, I think it can be easier just to say, forget it, we're just going to die, when the Spirit could be inviting really life-giving resurrection and innovation.
Yeah.
But it takes creativity to make that happen.
I completely agree. And to be fair, the near death and resurrection idea is just one of three or four images that he used to describe what some of these churches were going through. And I think one of the reasons it stuck out to me the most is because a lot of times when a church realizes it's in trouble, they do one of two things. They either double down on what they've been doing that isn't working because there's a number of reasons for that. Okay. Or they take a wild turn and start doing something that they think is culturally appropriate, culturally relevant, or that they've heard a church in a different city or even a different state is doing that supposedly works. And so they try to import that. And that's not like that. That's a move that's going to cause them, I think, to move more quickly towards death. It's not the kind of missiological reflection that Chris is encouraging in this article.
Right. And that was something that came up in the article. I started putting a star every time I saw him use the word culture or context, because it was being used different ways. Like sometimes it was positive and sometimes it was negative. He says, we need to let go and find our identity in neither contemporary culture nor in the past. So, you know, don't find your identity in contemporary culture. But then he ends the article by saying, find genuine contextualization among people and culture. And like, how do you do that? You know, and what he's really talking about, I think, is being aware of our motive. And are we doing this to follow a trend? Like you were talking about, like, mm-hmm. mimicking what's working in among somebody else, or, oh, this is the cool way to do church. Or are we following an invitation of the Spirit? So we are to be informed by culture. And be the, he talks about incarnation in the culture, but not just for culture's sake. And that's my question. Like, what are the theological buttresses that are kind of the non-negotiables that we need to have to make sure that this innovative expression of church is truly a part of the mission of God rather than just trend and aspiration? And I don't know. I mean, what do you all think? What would be, maybe this is a question for Flanders, I don't know, but what are the theological buttresses there that we would say this holds up church as we try to be cultural, but not because of culture?
So I have a thought about that. If I can continue on, Stephen, I don't think Chris missed this, but I think there's an incarnational step that we're missing when we think about what is cultural engagement. And if we decide what we think the culture needs, I think there's a lot of times that we can miss the mark on that. We have to go incarnationally into the culture and spend the time to build the relationships, to hear what the needs are so that we can address them appropriately with gospel categories. And I think that's where churches become afraid. They're afraid of the world. They're afraid to go into the neighborhood. They're afraid of what they've heard about the neighborhood. But that's the step that I think we have to take if we're going to contextualize. Otherwise, the question is, what are we anchoring the contextualization in? And if it's just our knowledge about what we think, I think that's a move from the self, as Chris is discussing Drive from Andrew Root.
So as I hear you talk about these things, both of y'all bringing out really important things from the article, it makes me think about, especially to your question, Tiffany, what are the theological buttresses that we innovate from, you know, that we hold on to, that define that? And I don't know. I mean, I think we could just throw out the constants, but that would just be, everybody says, I've got that, you know, we hold on to Jesus. We're going to worship in the Spirit. We're going to, you know, honor God and all these things, you know, they think that. But I think what's important in that is this sense of each church, it looks different in each church, that there's something about, something new has to come out of who they are. They are a particular expression of the fellowship because they are a set of people that don't exist anywhere else. They exist in that place. It's a collection of giftedness that is truly unique because that set of people does not exist anywhere else. It exists in that place, in that location, in that region or that corner of the community, that part of the city, on that intersection, here or there. And so there's something, it's the theological buttresses, but how they're manifested and how the people themselves interact with the giftedness that they have. And so there's got to be this awareness of themselves that that is able to honor those and live out of those giftedness, giftings in a good theological awareness, which then begs the question of who are the people who do that, who help them do that? And it's trained ministers I mean, that we're back to, we need trained ministers, but oftentimes we need trained ministers. It costs money. And then we're, and then some of the answers take them out of the ability to be able to be paid for their work. And so the question then becomes, what's the role of seminaries in training ministers who ultimately aren't going to get paid for what they're being trained to do, but have to figure out other ways to do that? And so if we have to have a people who are aware enough, trained enough to navigate the difference between the problems that you brought up, seeing culture as a wave of things that takes me away from the theological buttresses, or sets itself up as like, we interact with for churches to say the culture is bad. That's the worst thing to be said, because we're cultural manifestations. We look different than churches looked 100 years ago because we interact differently. We have different, you know, different ways of doing things, different ways of getting there, different ways of making things happen because of all the technological advances. It's part of culture. And so it's people that can navigate those things. And so it's this weird combination of all these things together. And so I have no answers, but those are the three things that stuck out to me, is the ability to see culture beyond it's bad or beyond it's the new wave. What happens, how people are trained, what happens in seminaries, how people are trained, not just for ministry, but for other kinds of work. And how do churches own up to their giftedness and as expressions of the theological anchors that hold us in place?
Yeah. Yeah. Stephen, I'm hearing that there can't be a blueprint application of this universally. And we like that. We like, you know, give me the purpose-driven church. Where's the book? And I'm going to set that up with my flags outside and the, you know, child check-ins in the left corner and the coffee shops on the right corner. And you go in and the lights are set at 2.5. And, you know, we just like this. This is what you do. Here's the church in a box. And here's the pattern, the blueprint on how to do it. But I think what Chris is saying and what we're observing, even Jeremy, in the very beginning, where you're talking about life spans of a church, that the church is a body. The church is dynamic. The church is a living thing. The church, Stephen talking about, it's the gifting of the people within it. And in that regard, of course, it has a culture. It is the culture of the kingdom of God, but it also reflects the culture of the place it is, where it's at. And that's not something to buck up against. I mean, that's something to acknowledge and embrace. This is who the church is in this space right now, as the Spirit's doing a new thing in this town, in this age, in this way. And what are the redeeming aspects of that culture? Maybe that's the answer to my question. It is where is the culture in which the Spirit is moving in my community overlapping with the culture of the kingdom of God? And how can we fully embrace that and live into it as a living body, a dynamic living body, in a way that is flourishing, as he defines flourishing, not nickels and noses flourishing, but a healthier way?
Yeah, I think about just the three of us. We're sitting in three culturally different regions of North America. And to completely replicate one place in each of our three places is ridiculous. You know, from the South to, you know, South or urban Southwest to Canada and Eastern Canada. I don't know how you say that, Jeremy. Eastern Canada.
It's Central.
Central Canada.
The big place up there.
Well, some would say Eastern, but
I was going to say, geographically, y'all are way on the east.
Well,
directions the same as us up there.
Ontario's the center of the world when you're in Canada. But don't tell other Canadians I said that.
We all exist in different places. And so culturally, we're already engaged in culture. And that, and I think we forget that. I think a lot of churches forget that. A lot of Christians forget that in those churches that fight against culture, this, you know, in quotes, culture. We're already kind of figuring out. So we've already made a step of finding some way to integrate with our culture, not in a bad way, but as an expression in what we do. The thing that really stood out to me in this, and I think this is kind of because each of us are in places that are in some way, at least comparatively to the things that Chris talks about, the stories he tells about in his article, we're in traditional churches. Now, you know, we might not be traditional in our as, you know, I would say we're a traditional church of Christ. Tiffany, I'd say that'd be your place too. And Jeremy, you're not in a church of Christ. I'm not sure how it fits traditionally with what you're talking about with your context, but if people are going to find us, they're going to look for us in under church. And that's not what Chris is talking about. Chris is pointing to something that people aren't going to find your normal ways. They're going to find them more organically through connections, through relationships. And I think about how does my church, it's not going to become something like that, at least not anytime soon, I could tell. But there are things that we need to do that are different. And Chris's, he points to Andrew Root's idea about the practices of letting go. And what that really speaks to me right now, I'm really taken by Ignatian spirituality, the idea of being able to live with an open heart, inner freedom, open hands on things, that we don't grasp things too tightly. And church is often about figuring out what are the things to hold on to, the theological buttresses that you mentioned, Tiffany, as well as what are things that we need to let go of and how do we do that? And I know our churches struggled through that over the last decade and a half to two decades about what do you hold on to and what do you let go of, and not let go of just like throw to the wind, but just you're not going to grasp so tightly on them that they hold you back in some kind of way. And it brings up the metrics that you mentioned, Tiffany, the, you know, if we're always measuring our success by nickels and noses, to use your words, you know, that's not going to be, it's not going to tell us how we're growing in the kingdom, the likeness to Jesus in which we're growing and how we're becoming that. So how do, you know, learning to know what to hold with open hands.
Yeah. Maybe it'd be good to list those. What he's citing here from Root, of you let go of what? He writes that question, let go of what? And I think that was my question when he introduced this idea of letting go. But the ones he cites are our misconception that numerical growth is the primary marker of God's kingdom, our attractional posture that we have, you know, seeker-friendly church, that attractional posture. The third one is our infatuation with the new and boredom with all things traditional. He says, letting go of our attachment to our current culturally shaped forms, which have grown comfortable in routine. So letting go of our comfort and our apathy, maybe. And then he says, letting go of our security, which might prevent us from hearing God's missional call that would lead to change. And finally, letting go of our traditionalism that does not remember that everything we think of as church was once done a first time. And all those are so great. I think we could talk about each one of those. The one that stands out to me the most is letting go of our attractional posture. And I'm drawn to that one because I've struggled with that. You're looking out at the Christian landscape right now in the West, in America, same for Canada. Y'all are just ahead of us on this, I think. But how do we describe this duplicitousness of what's happening? You know, what is it? Is it around hermeneutics? You know, they're reading the Bible one way and we're reading it another way. Is it grace and legalism? You know, what is it? And lately I've been thinking, you know, what it really might be is this idea of seeker focus. You know, the audience for churches over here are those on the outside. How do we bring them in? And the audience for other churches is the people who are already there. We're here to serve the body that's inside. And then we go out and we're light you know, it's missional in other ways, but our Sunday morning time together is for us, or our Sunday morning time together is for them, to bring them in. Maybe that's the divide. But anytime we're into that polarity of thinking, we can run into trouble. You know, it's more complicated than that. But what I hear Chris saying in this is, yeah, we're gathered around something common. It's for the body. It's the body together. But that in itself is missional. There's this juxtaposition of the, he calls it the indigenous people. You know, you have the sense of belonging among the people who are there. We're gathered together for each other, not for the seeker, but in a way that is missional. There's this juxtaposition, and that intrigued me, because I think I was resting too comfortably in this idea of, yeah, we're not doing church on Sunday morning for people who are seeking. I don't have to advertise the best music or the best new thing or water down the language because we're here for the disciples in the room. But I need to be pushed out of that kind of thinking. And how can this in itself be a missional approach? So yeah, I don't know which one of those spoke to you the most about roots letting go that he talks, but that was the one that got me thinking.
I was thinking about that one as well, Tiffany. You noticed a while back that when I came on the screen, my picture of my church was on the screen on my Zoom account, and it's really small. And so, like, we're like really, we can't see more than 50 in our sanctuary, and so 80% of that's 40. So when we've got 38 in there, the place looks full, and we don't have the resources to do anything. Like, we're not going to suddenly buy a new building or have the money to do an add-on. So there's some anxiety around how are we going to grow the church? And I've tried to lower the anxiety in the room by telling them, you know what, it's okay that we don't grow numerically. I said, I don't know if that's what God wants or not. We'll find out. And if that's what God wants, then a way will be found. But I've tried to put the idea into their midst that what we're trying to do when we're together is discern what it is that God is telling us that he wants us to do, how he wants us to be. And that's more important than having a professional worship service that might draw people in because of the quality of the worship leading or the quality of the preaching or, you know, whatever it is that we do. And so I think we have to start, in my experience, I'm only speaking for myself, I think we have to start with reshaping, like the letting go is reshaping around something else. It's helping folks reimagine what the kingdom is about and to see how the different things that they already do fit into that, or maybe they don't fit into that, or maybe they need to be modified towards that end.
Yeah, he redefines flourishing really well. I think when he says flourishing is less about membership growth or growth of monetary contributions, but more about joy and living into a new vision of discipleship and a journey on a missional adventure, if that's what we're gathered around. But still, to me, I mean, that's where I get stuck, and I need to sit with that for a while. When we're combining flourishing and mission, flourishing and missional, but you're not talking about numbers, you know, but it's missional. That's tricky for me to not get caught up in the enemy's lure of numbers, gathering around the wrong thing.
So I think that we get stuck in this phrase of growing the church with, and translate that directly in making our church have more people. And that's, I don't think anywhere do we read that in scripture. What's growing is really the kingdom. One, if anything's growing in participation numbers. It's the kingdom, it's kingdom people, but also what's growing is not numbers, but our hearts, our knowledge, our understanding growing deeper, our wisdom growing deeper. You hear that talk about that, that we as people are growing and we as a church are growing spiritually. That language is in there, that the numbers that are increasing are the people that are participating in the kingdom, not necessarily in one particular church. And so for people with, Jeremy, just as you described, with people with a limited space and limited resources, does not affect your ability, your church's ability to affect the world they live in as leaven in the culture around them.
That's right.
They're engaging culture every day by the way they go to the market, their businesses, that participate in their neighborhoods. And it may not grow your church specifically, but it's going to interaction in culture with your people in the community is going to open up someone's eyes, is going to trigger something in their hearts that realizes that they're longing for more and they're finding ways to connect with that. I think that that's the part of the deal. And the joy, that's what we're living out. And so that's a big conversion of thinking for traditional type of churches with places and budgets and titles and denominations or fellowships that they belong to, measuring numbers. And, you know, how do we find joy in what people are experiencing as we gather together and as what we're taking out without the express intention of the only way to measure, to really qualify or quantify that joy is to see how it's bringing people in.
Yeah, it's a total reframing. And like we talked about earlier, so many layers that touches not only in our ecclesiology, but our academics and how we think about missions, and it's a complete reframing. To put a positive note on this, I know we're getting close to winding down our conversation on this really great article, but it wasn't negative. I think we have a negative tone because it's overwhelming and it's so different and it's risk. But I was so down yesterday, church stuff. I mean, other things were going on, but just church despair and the fear of it and what's going to happen and what's tomorrow and what do these numbers look like, you know, that kind of thing, and just church stuff. But then I read this and was full of hope and joy and goodness. And it was so great because I'm reading about these churches. He has these little tiny blurbs, case studies, too big of a word, but these little blurbs of descriptions of different kind of churches and fresh expressions. Like, this church was down to 5 people and now they have 30. And it honestly struck me as good news. Like, this is a great thing. Or it was this church of 300 and now it's 30, 40 people who have dinner together twice a month and call it church. And it was such good news. There is beauty in that and joy in that in a new way that is, I think it's missional because it's authentic, it's genuine, and it's people who are committed to discipleship in a way that has deep, deep, deep meaning. And that is a good thing.
Yeah, I'm glad, Tiffany, that you shared that and called attention to the idea that we're trying to bring a positive tone to this. And I'd like to share a story from my church. And not that we or I are the heroes by any stretch, but it's I experienced it, and so it's in my memory. But we had in the couple years before I got there, the church had been in the habit of taking at Christmas time food boxes to a geared to income housing complex in our town. And I was hearing from church members, they were surprised that some of the folks didn't want the food boxes. And they you know, it was the customary thing of here's some food, but here's a Bible and here's a tract and here's a invitation to our church. And so it came up this year and they said, we need to take the food boxes to the housing complex. And I said, why? And they said, cause they need the food. I said, did anyone in that housing complex tell you that? And they said, no, we think they need it. And I said, well, that's the thing. We're not going to take it this year because, and I shared my experience in working with people in poverty is that a lot of times our efforts to help can be received wrongly or not received wrongly. They're receiving it the way they receive it, but they don't receive it the way we're intending. And so I said, what we need to do in the spring is just go down there and talk to folks and get to know them and find out who they are, what interests they have, and so on. A few weeks later, a church member came up to me and said, I was really influenced by what you said about this. I have a neighbor that I've been trying to invite to church for several months, and she always says no. But I just went to her house and said, I'd like to have you over to my house for tea. And she came, and we had a really nice visit, and I got to know her better. And I thought that's it right there. That's it. When we stop assuming that we know what's best for our church and for our community, and we put ourselves into a listening posture, that's when we can learn, and that's when we can hear, and that's when we can begin the process of discerning.
I love that, Jeremy. That's a great story. And I think that starts to dig into who we are as people and being relational. I love these stories that Chris goes with. And I like you said at the beginning, I don't want to get caught up in the stories, but to some extent, I do want to get caught up in the stories because I need those stories. I need those stories to wake me up. I need those stories to jar me. I need those stories to stand not as a contrast in a way, you're doing it wrong and they're doing it right. You know, that kind of thing. I don't see these stories as telling me I'm doing it wrong where I am and they're doing it right. I need these stories to show me how a community, how a Christian community is received by people who aren't looking for what we're experiencing as a church family. And we're experiencing a lot of life, but there's a lot of people that just, one, that's just not their rhythm of life. That's not their, they're recovering from different things. They have different relationships with church in the past that aren't helpful. And they're really sparked by these smaller communities or communities with really sharply focused missions or things that stand out, like the way they've talked about each one of these. Just beautiful expressions. And so the church as a whole needs our expressions of what we're doing. And even in more traditional, there's a lot of life and a lot of good things that are happening in the people who are in very traditional churches. But there's also, that's not the only way. No one should hold up their thing and say, this is the way everybody else has to do it. I want to celebrate the beauty of Christian community when it's experienced well and showing lots of life in whatever way. And so I need stories like this. I need stories that make me think and challenge me. It challenges me to think more, critically about what we're doing, to say, I'm certain about what we're doing, or I don't know if I'm not so certain about what I'm doing. It makes me think about, are we doing the right thing? Are we holding on to the right things? Are we letting go of the right things? These stories help me do that.
Yeah. They nurture imagination. You can look across the world even and say, hey, look what the Spirit's up to there. Look at the life that is being matured and grown in that space. And now not just, oh, it's working there, so let's plug and play it here, but Jeremy, like you're talking about listening with our community and having those conversations, let's see where this might overlap our culture and our context. And perhaps we can incarnate Christ in a similar way or a modified way in this space where it might just knock us out of our box thinking to come up with new ideas that would really work where we're at. It's encouraging. It's, to me, it's really inspiring and encouraging to see all these different things that God is doing that is so non-traditional. The stories he's telling from Appalachia and Presbyterian churches and Methodist churches and dinner churches and, you know, just all these third spaces. It is encouraging and life-giving, even if they're tiny little small groups of people. That's beautiful.
This has been a really good conversation. And I really like what Chris has to say. I love the way he points out at just at the beginning, these beautiful stories of new kinds of expressions, new kinds of communities. And I love the way that the rest of his article really challenges people to think about it. I love that he says that missiology challenges everybody, both people, traditionalists and people who are looking to innovate, to do it the right way, to think through well what's important and how do we do that from a gospel posture. Again, this article is called Kainos Koinonias. It is from the Mission Alive Substack. If you want to sign up to receive that on a regular basis, go to missionalive.org and sign up for the newsletter, and you will get that in your inbox on a regular basis and keep up with what Mission Alive is doing, at least the discussion that's happening around the innovative faith communities that Mission Alive is really leaning into. So we're thankful for that. Thankful for Chris and his wisdom and his experience. And Tiffany and Jeremy, thanks for reading and sharing from your experience as well, the article and what it means to you. And we'll catch you next time on the next episode of Discipleship Conversations.
Thanks for listening to this discipleship conversation. We invite you to share this episode and tune in next time for another conversation. We also invite you to subscribe and rate the podcast through your favorite podcast app. We'd love to hear from you. Send your comments and questions to media@missionalive.org. Check out the episode show notes and learn more about the podcast and other Mission Alive media resources at missionalive.org/media. Intro and outro music is by Audionautix.com. Mission Alive works to bring about the holistic transformation of marginalized communities through starting and renewing innovative churches that address the most challenging issues faced by their neighbors. Learn more about what we do and how to connect at missionalive.org.